all of us are used to maybe taking aspirin or ibuprofen, but all of us have somebody that have been hurt or lost. They just called out to me. And so how did we do it? We applied three very non-techy discipline. We followed the critical path. So this is project management. We applied lean principles, and then we applied business process management. And all the time, you're sitting on a product that's worth millions or potentially billions of dollars, and there are patients that are going without when this product is most valuable.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur's Logbook podcast, where we uncover the strategies and insights driving extraordinary business growth. Today, we're joined by Rami Khalil, CEO of Scimitar, a boutique management consulting firm dedicated to supporting the life science industry in solving complex challenges. With over 18 years of experience, Rami has built Scimitar into a trusted partner for both startups and Fortune 500 companies in the life science sector, ultimately helping those companies accelerate development timeline, achieve compliance more effectively, and ultimately get life improvement medicine to patients faster. Rami, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Zach. Really excited and looking forward to the conversation we have today.
Cool. I think perhaps the best place to kick things off would be to give some a high level of how you even got into the space. Because I've spoken to a lot of people in the life science space, and everyone has a different story. Some of them started as a scientist, and then some people just saw a major opportunity. So I'd love to start there.
Yeah. So maybe before I answer that one, we'll talk about what is the life sciences.
Sure.
Layperson to understand the breadth of the industry. And so, all of us are used to maybe taking aspirin or ibuprofen. Those are pharmaceuticals. Those are chemical drugs that have been produced or synthesized. In life sciences, we also include biotechnology. So those would be therapies derived from DNA. We would include diagnostics, so laboratory tests, as trivial maybe as the COVID tests that you used at home, to fancier diagnostic technologies. And then medical devices. Those can be anywhere from implants to devices used in healthcare delivery and facilities. And so we broadly call the life sciences, and it's very distinct from healthcare, where you're with insurance and so forth. So, but your question was, how did I get into it? And I think that story, this is a deeply personal story, but will probably resonate with most folks. And so the year before I went to college, my dad had a heart attack. And this was a long time ago, right? I have a big reunion coming on. This is a long time ago. And he had a triple bypass to treat the MI. And if you've ever seen the proceeding or interacted with somebody that has, it's devastating. They really just saw open the chest, take out the heart, farm some veins from elsewhere in the body, and stitch them in to bypass that clogged artery. And so, seeing my dad in that condition right before I left for college, that had left a thumbprint on me. And then in the first weeks that I was in school, I think it was the third day that I was on campus, I met an outgoing graduate, a senior that had just finished mechanical engineering program. And he was joining a firm that created stents, which are, tubular truss structures that are led to the clogged artery and expanded to hold it open. It's a minimally invasive procedure, meaning they don't have to do much to get the stents there. And I didn't know that these existed. And so I was immediately inspired by this sort of confluence in events. And it's all 2020 in hindsight, but I didn't realize this was happening and the connection with my dad and this. And anyway, I became an engineer and I joined a stent company shortly after graduation, and had the privilege to work on products that have benefited the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. And I would meet folks at the airport, and it just reinforced a career and a commitment to life sciences. So I think I picked up the mission pretty early in life. And that came from, having a family member that suffered through some, procedure, cancer. It could be Alzheimer's, it could be cardiovascular disease, but all of us have somebody that have been hurt or lost in our lives. And so it just called out to me.
So you had like really like that personal experience in a way with obviously like your father decided he went through like that process. You saw like how intrusive like those could be. And then eventually he became like an engineer. So you were able to really get like that hands-on experience and really be more like involved in like the industry. It's like before that you somewhat saw like the impact behind it. But once you were like directly in the industry involved, you got to see like behind the scenes in a way. And see perhaps like any way that there could be improvement in like the life science industry.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I learned was that there's always a better way.
Oh yeah. Of course.
And once you see that, you know, you can't unsee it. And then there's that ability to bring the creativity. Well, somebody, some physician or engineer together, they thought about, hey, is there a better way to address, you know, the post heart attack treatment? You know, is there a better way instead of a bypass surgery? And they brought that creativity and the need together and came up with that, you know, a new therapy. And I think this is what is pervasive in our industry, right? There's always the need for more and better treatments. Like standards of care get outdated and the quality of life can always be improved. The length of life can be improved. And so there's just this continuous opportunity, and let's call it a renewable population of customers, right? Like we all care about this and we all want the creativity of the life sciences to continue because mm-hmm. we're bound to benefit. And if not us directly, then our friends and family, right?
Yeah. And I like the fact that you were talking about, like, we could always be better, be more efficient. Some of like switching gears, touching a bit onto like bringing like new products to market, like new innovation, et cetera. Cause like nowadays, like AI, like all this new technology coming up, there's a lot going on like the shelf, like new markets, new clinical trials, et cetera. And one thing that I thought was really interesting is in like our first conversation, which I thought was actually really interesting, was the fact that a lot of people, including like myself, first thing that we're going to think about is like, okay, like if we have technology, like AI, it's going to help like just be more efficient. We're going to be able to get things to market faster. But oftentimes what you mention is it's actually like the total like opposite. Sometimes it's really just simple thing that don't even involve technology in like the first place. And that just like makes you think. I'd love for you perhaps to walk us through like how you approach removing like the unnecessary time from like the development process, even like before we even look at including technology in that process. From what I could understand, technology somewhat comes second, and from my mind that's like counterintuitive in a way.
Yeah, this is I really appreciate the question. So Scimitar, our consulting firm, one of our core offerings, we just call it development acceleration. And in the life sciences, we generally look at research. This would be the early biology, you know, the chemistry, the study of what opportunities there are and what chemical entities we can develop to address certain biological pathways. So research. And then we call development, usually we say R&D, but development refers to when we enter into a human being and begin to run clinical trials. And this proves the safety and efficacy of therapies in a clinical setting, in a human setting. And so we offer this development acceleration as part of our core service. Now, yeah, there is a tremendous opportunity for AI within drug development, research development, every aspect of it, manufacturing, mm-hmm. commercialization. But we have a fascinating case study that I love to share, directly measurable, quantifiable from a client. And so they asked us to help them reduce the time, the cycle time, from when their final clinical trial ends to when they submit their data package, we call it a regulatory submission, to health authorities. And in the United States, we have the Food and Drug Administration as the primary regulator, but every country has their own globally. And so it took them about 26 weeks, 6 months, to package the entire life cycle of data that was generated, not just from the clinical trials, but also from the early research, to submit this to the US FDA or global health authorities. And this is a fascinating period of time because you've just proven clinically the 10 years of development and investment is safe and effective. And then it takes you another 6 months to submit the package. And then it takes many more months for the reviewers to go through and validate it. And all the time you're sitting on a product that's worth millions or potentially billions of dollars. And there are patients that are going without when this product is most valuable. And so shrinking the cycle time is very critical. So they wanted to shrink the cycle time in half, maybe go from 6 months to 3 months. And their portfolio finance group, looking at all of the drugs in development, valued this at just under $1 billion. Right. Okay. So this was huge value to patients and huge top line value to our client. And so they had allocated quite a bit of funding for technologies to accelerate all of the processes that are used to synthesize and package all of this data. And we were running this program with them, designing the work. And what we found, what we actually executed, we brought them to 12 weeks in about 18 to 24 months. It was hugely cross-functional work. And we did it long before, years before any of that technology investment was ready for commercial use. And so how did we do it? Right. We applied three very non-techy disciplines, right? We followed the critical path. So this is project management. Understand what's driving your end-to-end cycle time. We applied lean principles, which you would find in any manufacturing organization, but we did it to knowledge work. So we structured this knowledge work and then we leaned it out. And then we applied business process management. We need to do this repeatedly, consistently. And those three disciplines combined gave us 3 month reduction off of this 6 months. Now, that was before the technology. And so with the technology, you can go even further.
Right? But,
yeah. What's interesting to note is most of the I'm going to call it waste in the system was due to cross-functional handoffs not being clearly mapped or deliverables and dependencies not being known. Oh, I didn't know you were waiting for this document. Well, you know, now we do, and we can deliver that document. Or, hey, I could shave weeks off of my work if you included me in a single conversation. And so this was pervasive throughout the entire system across all of these functions. And none of it needed technology. What it needed was a steward and attention to how the system was working. And so that's what we brought as a consultancy. But then you need to leave behind that stewardship, that ownership of the end-to-end. And so we put the infrastructure and the training in place so that they could continue to hit their 12 weeks and even continue to accelerate, reduce their cycle times longer than 12 weeks with standard continuous improvement methodologies. And then when the technologies came, the actual cycle times of the human work, like the medical writers that might be authoring documents or the biostatisticians that are analyzing the data, like we can reduce the cycle time of those using the technologies, but technology wasn't going to help creating the human connections in a human driven system. And so that's where, you know, I'm a big believer that if you step back and you look at the system, you could drive a lot of speed without technology. And that's just super low hanging fruit.
Yeah.
And we create ownership for that, drive the continuous improvement, and then bring the technology in and you'll go even faster.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if I would call it like human error in a way, but it's perhaps just like a miss of like collaboration in like some shape or form where people are not exactly sure. Okay, like you've sent me this document like a week ago. If you included me in this one email thread, we would have gone in like 2 weeks earlier, then this process would move along. So again, it falls onto like project management in a way, like having clear deadlines, timeline, knowing what is due, what isn't due, etc. So you can streamline that. But just by being more efficient with that, which isn't even really AI or technical, just basic project management, you can streamline that. You mentioned from like 26 weeks, like 12, like you slash down like half, like directly, even like a little bit less than half. And you didn't even use like technology yet, which I think is like really interesting. And for like those companies, when you implement like a process like that, is that something that's like repeatable, like reusable onto like other projects that they work on as well? Or is it more like case by case basis?
Well, I think the exact solutions will be different if you apply the same thinking in a different part of the value chain. But if we looked at how clinical protocols, so this is, you know, the study design for a clinical trial is drafted, and all the parties that need to be involved to design a clinical trial, they can use the same exact methodologies, right? It's understanding your critical path, it's understanding the waste from handoffs in the system, and it's putting a sustainment framework, a business process management framework on top to make sure it's repeatable. And you could reduce cycle times in that space. You could do it with commercial launches and the preparedness of commercial launch. So I don't think that this was specific in any way, shape, or form to regulatory submissions per se. And then in those areas, you can bring the relevant technologies to bear as well. And that would further reduce the cycle times of the actual tasks that humans are engaging in. But there's so much in cross-functional teams. There's always a lot of noise and drift, and developing a system or a way to bring people together and find that best pathway to deliver the end-to-end work, that's very low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. And I know you obviously mentioned like that one example case study, like that one client. Is there like any other like common areas that you see like a lot of companies like really be inefficient with like their approach, like either go to market or just development process? Anything that like comes to mind there?
Yeah. And it happens, I think, pervasively throughout the value chain of our industry. So site startups, you know, clinical trials, they run across the globe, and you need clinical sites popped up that are agreeing or supporting that clinical trial and enrolling patients. And so site startup, selecting sites, and then getting them mobilized to support a clinical trial. Really, really easy example where you could do the same. There's a lot of players involved in the decision-making mobilization, and how do we coordinate them effectively. In the manufacturing space, there's a tight coordination that has to take place across the supply chain and the manufacturing network, especially as you get closer to launch. So making small scale for clinical and then growing your supply base for commercial readiness is another key example. And I talked about commercial launch. And so if you have commercial teams that are bringing their promotions and sales and messaging and key opinion leaders together, another vastly cross-functional area to get ready for product launches. And so in almost every core area of value chain, there's tremendous opportunity to really tighten up, I'll call it, how organizations work. Now, this is a phenomenon you see in larger orgs. If you're still pre-commercial and smaller and everybody's sitting in the same building,
different story.
It's a different story, but you know, there they have different challenges, like what capabilities should we be building versus how do we optimize the capabilities we already have. So this speed issue is one that you largely see in the bigger pharma and biotech companies.
Yeah. So it's like those startups are more focusing on like the MVP, like getting like a minimum viable product. And then like the organization larger or more around like optimization, making things more efficient, et cetera, from like what I could get there.
Yeah. And those orgs are maybe working on one product. So the team is already deeply focused. But, you know, if I'm running a department that is serving 10 products, maybe the way I'm allocating my resources can be improved to drive the throughput. So there's tons of opportunities in the larger portfolio companies to drive speed. And it's a different challenge than the smaller startup field companies.
Yeah, it obviously depends on like the client. And one thing I'd be curious about, like working extensively with like those large like vertical departments and like life science organizations, is there any like common challenges that you see these verticals facing when it comes to actually trying to like develop and execute their functional strategy?
Yeah, this is a fascinating question.
I have a feeling you could talk about that for hours.
I could. You know, I'm going to say like I'm sort of middle of my career right now. I'm at the point where I'm firing on all cylinders, but I think my professional age is much higher because I've had the opportunity to sit on multiple leadership teams as an advisor multiple leadership teams for 1 to 2 years each. So through a life cycle of development for each of these teams, multiple at the same time. And so if I'm supporting five leadership teams, I'm getting 10 years of leadership team experience, you know, across those 2 years that I'm helping them. And I've observed some common patterns. And what I will say is, you know, strategy has to start with your leadership for sure. But each of these leadership teams is living a very similar experience. They all have the, you know, the remit of their function that they have to deliver. That's basic. That's why they're getting a budget to run their department. They have to find the strategy of that department. They have to manage their budgets. They have to, you know, deal with their people and develop them. And so they all have common challenges. And what I've found time and time again is that leadership teams are using their very limited leadership time to do those things. And if you really want to drive an evolution of a department, you need to do those things faster and more effectively. We call that the racetrack. These are things you're going to do every year over and over again. You've got to do budget planning. You've got to do performance management and staff development. You've got to deliver your portfolio. And so if we can drive efficacy in leadership teams and use their very limited time, maybe they meet every 2 weeks for 2 hours, almost 52 hours of collaboration time a year. That's trivial. That's not a lot to run a huge department. And so we want to use that time effectively. And if we can bring the operational repetitive work down to about 60% of their bandwidth, then that leaves a lot of bandwidth for the strategic planning. And then we can do real strategy, not just fixing pain points here in the org, but assessing the landscape, assessing technology, assessing changing regulation, and figure out what do we want to be as an org and start to drive towards that. And so once we tighten up leadership team operations, we can really invest a whole lot more in strategic planning. And it sounds trivial, but once again, this is the human element. There are new people in the workplace, new generations needing to learn the basics of leading teams and organizations over and over again. And so this opportunity to tighten up ops so that you could focus on the strategy piece is a recurring theme with every LT that I've worked with. And once they've created that bandwidth and leaders have that ability to spend an hour or two a day thinking about what do I want my organization to feel like? What culture do I want there? What experience do I want from my employees? What experience do I want from my customers and stakeholders? It's just immediate transformation that can take place. And then you start to build momentum towards whatever strategic end, you know, any organizational leader wants to set. But it all starts with having the time. I just ask anybody that's watching this video, right? Probably entrepreneurs. Leaders in their organizations are trying to grow orgs. How much could you do if you had an hour a day to think? Just to think about
it's business. Like that concept of like working in the business and working on like the business. It sounds like the leadership that you're mentioning, like they're focusing on like the operation, like they're working in, but if they're doing that strategic thinking planning, then it's more focusing like on the business, like planning ahead, trying to like find any growth opportunities, looking at what's going on in like the industry. And I feel for like any listeners, it'll probably resonate with a lot of people. Like I know myself sometimes, like I'll be working in the business. I'm like, okay, like I should be focusing on that, which is probably like the highest like ROI that I can do by focusing my time on that. So I think this somewhat applies like a lot of industries, but I definitely do see it applying like really heavily to life science too.
Oh yeah, it's I think across any leader and any leadership team. And so if you can take your operational work, the running the business, working in the business, and shrink it down and give yourself the bandwidth to work on the business, then you're going to have a very successful business. I think we all see that. So, but that's just the most basic lesson. Then, you know, we have methodologies that we use to work on the business and implement strategic planning. We can get into those if you think it's interesting.
One of the things that I'd be somewhat curious about, and like shifting gear a bit, because I've worked with companies in like the life science space, et cetera. And like one common theme that I've seen is if there's a company working with them, there's always going to be like regulatory challenges, compliance that you have to be like very careful. I would say that's more applicable if you're trying to like promote or like market like a company, but that's still something that you do have to like keep in mind. Is there like an approach they take to balance the need for speed of actually going to like market or anything like that, but also maintaining like that quality to actually like adhere to like those compliance standards?
Yeah, yeah. This is fascinating. And if I do have any life sciences listeners, I have to be very careful in how I answer this. And so I'm going to take the hard line first. And the hard line is we never compromise quality and compliance in the life sciences. That's just not permissible. We call it the right to operate. We can never lose our right to operate. And there are opportunities to sort of do things in the clinical space, in how you manage your data or how you, hopefully you enroll your patients. You can drift in the manufacturing space. And so we care about quality across the value chain. Research is good laboratory practice. In clinical, it's good clinical practice, GCP. And in manufacturing, we call it GMP, good manufacturing practice. And that has to be followed and applied across the board. No compromise on that. Now, here's my however, right? Regulations are drafted and interpreted. And a lot of the times, quality systems can be deployed forgetting to look back at the regulations. And oh, I did this at this company, I might as well do it this way at this company. And we have found time and time again that we see our clients overbuilding on quality in a way that doesn't benefit or protect patients, but does slow down your operations. And so there is an opportunity across the board to take a look at, is quality acting in service of the patient in accord with regulations? And if it's not, what's the purpose of that? Maybe challenge some of the vestigial structures or sort of some of the norms that may have been adopted or transferred. And so when the cost of quality or the impact of quality on productivity grows to a breaking point, then you know our clients will sometimes want to revamp their quality management systems. And when we're invited to support that, we tie back to the regulations, which are very thoughtfully crafted. We take a look at how they're interpreted in the organization and make sure that it's in line with serving patients and serving business, and try to prune back some of what might have been overgrown in the process, right? So if you come into an organization and they have 1,500 SOPs to run their business, something's probably wrong with probably how they're managing this. So I can't imagine any of their employees are reading and complying. And so what you want to do is promote a culture of quality and let people function freely, not leave things to interpretation, but make sure it's always in service of patients and in accord with regulations.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting, the point they mentioned earlier, because when you take like too long, you go through like a lot of quality compliance when you already have a product that's working, it fits like all like the compliance aspect of things, like it is quality, but you're trying to like add more, 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 more. But by doing that, you're somewhat hurting yourself, but also the patient that could benefit from having like that medicine product, etc., by slowing down the time that it takes to actually get to like market. So even though that you have like the best interest of like the customer in mind of making sure that it's 110% like amazing quality, you're somewhat hurting them as well by not being able to get that to them as soon as you can, while obviously maintaining like quality standards there. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, keep the patient in mind, right? For everything that we do, is this going to be, you know, product impacting? If it's not, let's ask ourselves, or if this is going to compromise the quality of our data, right? So in clinical setting, you're where essentially you're collecting data and you need to know that the data you're collecting is accurate, complete, comprehensive, timely. Of course, you need to put those controls in place, but you know, there are oftentimes layers that get added that don't actually support a regulation or requirement, but don't benefit patients. And those are the ones we need to trim back.
I love that. And like, as we wrap things up, one thing that I always like to ask any guests that we have on the podcast is some of like looking like ahead, like how do you see the industry some of like evolving for like life science companies that want to accelerate to market? And is there anything that leaders should be preparing for? There's obviously like AI that we obviously talked about, like really briefly, technology, etc. You did mention like earlier that most of the efficiency isn't even related to technology. But in my opinion, there has to be some sort of component in like the next few months, years.
Yeah. So let me clarify some thinking there. I think you can drive speed and you don't need a ton of technology. But productivity, especially in the age of AI, is productivity, getting, you know, a greater unit output for your total budget or unit input, is of a concern for an organization. And I do think we're going to see you need to be at the forefront of technology adoption. And so regardless of what industry you're in, life sciences or any other, wherever content is being generated, that is a massive AI-enabled opportunity. And so across the value chain of life sciences, we're generating content. It could be medical writers, it could be promotional materials in the commercial space, it could be reports validating that a piece of equipment is grading the way it needs to. It's just content, content, content. This is mostly knowledge work that's taking place across the organization. And so I think that every life sciences senior leader needs to have an approach to this. And it first starts with access. I need to make technologies available to my organization. I need policies around that. And so how do I promote healthy access? And then there's a people issue. You have generations in the workforce, right? And getting me to work on ChatGPT is a lot easier than getting, you know, my mom to work on GPT or try any technology. And so you need to manage the people aspect of this. And that human capital planning or workforce planning could be around, you know, bringing new training into the organization. It could be adding new roles and phasing other roles out. Whatever it is, we need a people strategy, because without people, the engine of our creativity and delivery. Okay. So I think we get access and people. And then the last piece is, I think, around scale and control. So if I look at the end-to-end value chain of just life sciences, research, clinical development, manufacturing, tech ops, commercial, there are thousands of use cases across the value chain.
Yeah.
Am I going to allow this to be a free-for-all in my organization, or am I going to have some method to scale and control this and find some sort of consistency of, you know, application or business case? And I think that the AI has come really fast. Everybody will talk about the pace at which it hit the economy more broadly. So we have to create access quickly. We have to get our people ready to adopt, but then we have to control it and scale it out simultaneously. It's a lot of challenges, but this is where I think leaders need to be focused. And I look at our industry, and we're at that time point where every part of the value chain is evaluating for itself what it needs from AI to drive productivity while the industry is still emerging, right? Like, there's no leader for XYZ task. And so I think over the next 2 years, we're going to see a lot of product development, use case applications, and then leadership has to be ready to scale and control those from an adoption perspective.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot in like the next like few years. I know myself, I've played with like a few like AI tools, like beyond just the ChatGPT, I was able to like build softwares and apps in like literally one prompt. I was like, okay, this is crazy. A lot of application that we could use for that. So I can't even imagine what we'll see in the life science space here. But yeah, I really appreciate your time, Remy. And if there's like anyone that wants to get in touch with you, is there like any platform that they should like find you on or like look you up on? Or
yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, Rami Khalil. You can find us at scimitar.com and reach out as well. I'm like really excited if we have any listeners in the life sciences and you have any transformations or major initiatives, give us a call. Or if you want to shoot the breeze, shoot an email, reach out on LinkedIn. But thanks, Zach, for having me.
Perfect. Well, really appreciate your time, Remy.